This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, our guests include Ron Gomez, former state lawmaker, former voice of the USL Ragin' Cajuns basketball team, and he was the voice of the Cajuns back in the heyday of Coach Burl Shipley in the 1970s when USL rose to number 7 in the polls for 2 consecutive years. Burl Shipley integrated basketball in Louisiana. He ended up with a tarnished reputation as his program went on NCAA probation, but he'll be inducted in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame this week. We'll talk with Ron Gomez about the legacy of Burl Shipley. Also, Damian Eccles and Lori Davis. Their book is Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row. Eccles served 18 years on death row in Arkansas. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Ron Gomez, veteran lawmaker from Lafayette and also a longtime journalist and an author of renown. His 2000 autobiography, My Name is Ron and I'm a Recovering Legislator, is one of the best books ever written about Louisiana politics and government. We'll talk with him about his varied career, but in the early 1970s, late 1960s, Ron Gomez was the voice of the USL, then USL, Ragin' Cajuns basketball team. The coach was a man named Burl Shipley, who is to be inducted this week in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame at Natchitoches. Burl Shipley is one of the most controversial figures in collegiate sports history, but he left quite a mark on basketball and on race relations in Louisiana. And Ron Gomez, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
You knew him well. You knew Coach Shipley well.
Yes. Yeah, we were very close friends, and he had asked me to write a book about his travails with the NCAA for maybe 10 years. And I was asked by various people not to do that. And I refused. And he went through 3 or 4 different other authors, even paid them money. And they just didn't produce what he was looking for. So I finally, once his brother, Tom Shipley, who was from Michigan, sent me the material that he had gotten from the archives at USL, then USL, and Dr. Audemars, who was president of the university, through the Freedom of Information Act. Tom sent me a whole batch of documents, and I decided that then and there I would write the story. And with those documents, with that background, we did that. And the book is called Slam Dunked, because that's what they were by the NCAA. And it's a story of integration of the Deep South sports, which Burl Shipley was the first to integrate, the first man to recruit black players in the South, really, in the whole South. The only other school that had done that was Texas El Paso, if you call that the South. I call it the West. And Texas El Paso had beaten Kentucky in the finals of the NCAA with an all-black team.
Well, they were Texas Western in those days.
That's right. You got it, Jeff.
And shortly thereafter, Burl Shipley, after being at what is now UL, then USL, recruits black athletes and signs 3 of them. And what happens?
Well, the NCAA, the State Board of Education, Stanley Galloway, actually they had signed 4. And one was declared ineligible to sign at UL because Stanley Galloway, who was Commissioner of Athletics of the State Department of Education at the time, said that this young man had signed with Grambling first, which was, according to Burl, not true. But anyway, he went to Grambling, and actually, they said he had signed with McNeese, but he ended up at Grambling. So there were 3 of them. There were Winkler, Marvin Winkler, Elgin Ivory, and Scott from Baton Rouge. And those three came here, and Leslie Scott was the only one from Louisiana. Winkler was from Indianapolis and had broken all of Oscar Robertson's high school records while he was there. And Elgin Ivory was from Birmingham, Alabama. Scott was from Baton Rouge, and he didn't last through one whole semester, I don't believe. I don't think he started more than two or three times.
Well, he not only faced the wrath of Louisiana officials, but fans did not treat the team warmly. You had to have a police escort when you went to certain places in the state, didn't you?
Yeah, the local fans were very receptive to the idea. They loved it, and we had massive crowds for all of our games, and they loved the black players. When we went on the road, however, it was a different story. We went to Pineville first, and we were greeted there by a band playing Dixie the whole time we played, and we beat them soundly. Then we went to Ruston, and we had to have a police escort up there. And they escorted us into the gymnasium and, in fact, escorted me to my spot. And a state trooper sat with me the whole time. And that was a rough game, and we ended up winning that one. But then we went on the road and lost about seven straight games because Burrell would take on the biggest and the best at that time.
Right.
He wanted to play big league basketball, and he did.
Well, and he got there shortly thereafter. USL and advanced to the round of 16 2 years in a row in the NCAA tournament with the nation's top scorer in Dwight Bow Lamar from Columbus, Ohio, a black player. Right. Yep. And then the roof caves in. What happened?
Well, first of all, Stanley Galloway, Commissioner of Athletics for the state of Louisiana, ordered Burrell to hold an out-of-season practice with the black players. And the reason for that was to tell them that they hadn't made the team. Well, they were so outstanding that you couldn't tell them they didn't make the team. And he had asked the president of the university, who was Clyde Ruggio at the time, if he could recruit black players, and in Ruggio's typical way, said, "Go get them, Hoss," because he called everybody Hoss. But anyway, Burrell went after the black players and got the three of them, and was playing them, and that brought on the wrath of the State Board of Education. They quietly, but Stanley Galloway reported them to the NCAA that they had this early practice. And, of course, he had ordered them to hold the early practice. And it was a locked-door practice at Earl K. Long Gym here on the UL campus. And the black players made the team, of course, and Burrell reported that to Galloway. And Galloway said, "Well, in that case, we can't give them scholarships." So I and a group of other people here at Lafayette decided that we would find a way to get the scholarships for the kids. So we raffled a car off, an old car given to us by George, from Lafayette Motors, and George Roy was. And Mr. Roy gave us this old car, and we raffled it off, mainly in the black community, and raised enough money for the scholarships for the three kids. So we dedicated the scholarships to them, and that, Galloway said, was a violation of state rules that you could not give, violation of NCAA rules, that you could not earmark money for scholarships for one player. We had done that for three of them. And so they reported it to the NCAA, and the NCAA came in and put UL on probation. But they could still play. So we played the next 2 years under probation. And Burrell, in the meantime, recruited other black players, Fred Saunders from Columbus, Ohio, and of course Bo Lamar and Roy Ebron and a couple of others, and had them on the squad. Well, then the NAIA came up, and we were chosen as one of the teams to go to the NAIA. Well, they had black players at the NAIA championship tournament in Oklahoma City. And our president folded to the State Board of Education and reported to Burrell that he was ordered not to allow the team to play in Oklahoma City or in Kansas City. So Burrell told the team that, and of course they were heartbroken, and that the students rose up against the president, marched on his home that night. Dean Abel was the only person that could control them and told them that he would talk to the president and have him meet with representatives of the students the next morning. And they did. And when they did, then Joel Fletcher, who was president of the university, reported that they could go to Kansas City after all.
All right. Well, we could talk all night about those years, but what happened at the end of the 73 season? What caused the team to get the death penalty?
Well, the NCAA had investigated UL, and UL had not answered any of the charges at that point in time. They did finally in the summer of 1973, and they answered the charges in a massive paper written by Sammy Cosper, the vice president of the university, who had, by the way, vetted our book and put the okay on it. And the Burrell at that time asked for a raise. He had gotten a $1,000 raise. He was making $15,000 and some odd $100. And he got the $1,000 raise, which he refused 2 years earlier because he said he deserved better than that. And the president told him at that time on a Friday that he would get back to him on Monday and he would check to see if he could make it. And Burrell called him on Monday morning, and Dr. Russo said, "Well, Hoss, I couldn't get in touch with anybody from the Board of Education, and so we won't be able to give you the raise." And Burrell said, "Well, in that case, I resigned." And he called me, and he called another sports writer here, J.C. Hatcher, and asked us to please call the other media and ask for a press conference. And at that press conference, Burrell resigned, to the surprise of all of us. And it was not because of the NCAA investigation. It was because he didn't get the raise.
But a month later, it is revealed that there was widespread academic fraud, that he paid his players.
Correct.
Did he get what he deserved?
Well, I don't know. That's a question to be answered by the ages, I guess. Did he get what he deserved? I don't know. He resigned because he didn't get the pay raise. The NCAA did find that they were guilty of a number of charges. The university didn't answer any of the charges until too late. The NCAA then put the university on not only probation but suspension. They suspended the basketball program for 2 years, and they put all the other athletics on probation. But the basketball team couldn't play at all for 2 years. That just about killed everything here. You know, it sent all the players to different universities. Saunders went to Syracuse, and one of the others went to Mercer University. And they just spread out all over the nation. Bo Lamar finished his school here and married a gal from here and ended up working here for a long, long time and just recently moved back to Columbus, Ohio. And anyway, the NCAA put him on suspension and suspended the program. That was the first time they had done that since the Kentucky violation in the 1940s.
Well, do you think he should be in the Hall of Fame?
Absolutely. I think he should have been 30 years ago.
Well, unfortunately,
it was because of a couple of sports writers who blackballed him, that he wasn't.
He died in 2011. We'll talk more about Burrell Shipley and a few other matters with Ron Gomez when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number, and a bit more time with former state lawmaker Ron Gomez, who was a journalist of renown and the play-by-play voice of the UL Ragin' Cajuns for nearly 20 years, and he was at the mic when Burl Shipley was doing great things on the court, and ultimately Coach Shipley, at the age of 46, resigned abruptly. The program went on probation, was given the death penalty, and Shipley is remembered as one of the worst cheaters in the history of college basketball, but his legacy is quite complex. He is the man who integrated the sport in 1966, and to put it in perspective, in 1961, LSU was not allowed to even play teams that had black athletes. 20 years later, Dale Brown had a team that went to the Final Four that had an all-black starting lineup. In fact, white players on the 1981 Tigers scored fewer than 100 points for the whole season. So Burl Shipley paved the way for Dale Brown and others to have success with African-American athletes. And for that, he is being justifiably acknowledged in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame as a member, the greatest shrine in Louisiana. It'll happen this week, and Ron, you will be there, will you not?
Absolutely. We'll be selling books, the slam dunk book that Burl and I wrote together, at the Holiday Inn Express, which is the headquarters for the induction ceremonies.
Go ahead.
I wanted to say this, that Tom Cox, who was assistant coach for Burl during the heyday years, offered, in fact, there was a group of us that got together about 5-10 years ago and tried to get the LSWA, the Louisiana Sports Writers Association, to induct Burl into the Hall of Fame. Why have they not? Robertson from Louisiana Tech was inducted. Dale Brown was inducted. They both had suffered NCAA violations over their career, and they were still inducted. But anyway, Burl had not been. And Burl had, the document that the USL, Sammy Cosper, vice president of USL, submitted to the NCAA should have been taken by the NCAA, and all but three of the charges should have been thrown out because of that document. But they ignored it because it was late getting in, frankly.
All right. Mike on I-10. Mike, you're on the air with Ron Gomez. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I live in Baton Rouge now, but I'm from Columbus, Ohio.
I tell you what, Mike, please call back, and we'll get you on. But Columbus, Ohio, of course, produced some great stars for UL during those days, including Bo Lamar.
Robert Winkler.
36 points a game in 1972, and scored 100 points that year in the NCAA tournament. In fact, he scored 175 points in 2 years in the NCAA tournament. No other Louisiana athlete, including Shaquille O'Neal, has ever done that. And he was a great player in college and had some success as a pro, but he is tied to the years in which UL not only advanced to the top 10, but also Coach Shipley was accused of paying these players, and he acknowledged to John Ed Bradley that he did offer some cash payments of what he said for humanitarian reasons.
Yeah. Well, as Burl had put it a couple of times to me, when a kid shows up and his tennis shoes have no soles on them, you got to buy him new tennis shoes. And so he did that, and he gave them gasoline money for traveling around and this, that, the other type thing, which was against NCAA rules. You know? But Tom Cox, like I was going to say before, the assistant coach under Burl during those days, Tom and a group of us got together and tried to get the LSWA to install Burl as a member of the Hall of Fame. Tom went to New Orleans and met with a couple of the writers who had blackballed Burl before. And he said, he told them at the beginning of the interview, he said, I will take a lie detector test and I'll pay for it. And I want to tell you exactly what happened during those years. And they said, no, we'll get it from Burl Shipley or we won't print it at all. And he, Tom Cox said, Burl Shipley would talk to you on a bet. And Burl really felt that way. He would not talk to any of the sports writers in Louisiana because they had refused to conduct him.
All right. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Ron Gomez. Hi, Dan.
Hi. As I recall from your book, you were quite critical of Governor Edwards for putting himself and his cronies ahead of the public he was elected to serve. You have the same sentiments about Governor Jindal, putting his personal ambition ahead of what's best for Louisiana and its citizens.
To a degree, yeah, Dan. Not as much as I did Edward Edwards. Edward Edwards was, he was an amoral person. General, I think, is moral, but he has his sights set on the presidency, and he's doing everything he can to do that, rather than govern Louisiana as it should be. But I don't think there's any immorality about General. I think there was about Edwards.
Now, 25 years ago, and it's hard to believe it's been 25 years, David Duke sashays into the House and joins you as a member of the Louisiana House of Representatives. And you're one of the people who knew him when he was stirring up trouble, if you will, at LSU in his early years and when he was in the Klan, because you had interviewed him as a journalist.
Yeah, he came in to our radio station and asked our young news editor, news director at the time, for an interview. And the guy came back to me and said, and I was manager of the station at the time, and he said, David Duke is here from the Ku Klux Klan. He wants me to interview him. What do you want me to do? And I said, well, let me interview him. If I'm going to lose my license, I'm going to lose it because of something I did. So I interviewed David at the time, and he was a very nice guy, very nice young man. And he handled himself very well, as you know, as he could do. And we did the interview, and he left, and that was the end of it. Then the next time I saw him was when he was inaugurated as a representative in the state legislature. And I didn't recognize him, frankly, because he had had so much cosmetic surgery. And he had changed his looks totally. He had built up his body completely with weights, and he had had his nose done and cheekbones set in his cheeks. And he just was a good-looking guy, and he had blonde hair parted in the middle and done in today's style, and just a really good-looking guy. And he knew it, and he walked around preening the whole time he was there. In fact, one time before, about 2 weeks before he was to get on national television, he showed up after a weekend with his face very, very red, and he said he had fallen asleep while suntanning. But there were lines, straight lines along his cheekbone, where it obviously was a skin peel. And I had called my wife and asked her, what does a skin peel look like? And she told me, and I said, well, that's what he had. And he had had that done so that his face would be just totally clear when he went on television, which it was. And he looked great.
Yeah, but there was the past. And
yes, there was.
Yeah.
And he showed it in the legislation that he produced mm-hmm. in his first year there. He didn't pass anything. He had one bill that was passed out of the House, and it was an innocuous nothing bill. But he tried several different types of bills. One was the implant of the birth control device that could be implanted in the upper arm. And he was going to do that to all the welfare mothers of the state, which would be an enormous cost, for one thing. And the way we would beat his bills was we would send a freshman legislature to the mic, and unbeknownst to Duke, they would move to put the bill back on the calendar, which effectively kills it. And he would not even know what was going on. He didn't know the rules of the house well enough to know what was going on. So the guy would move, and we would vote to put it back on the calendar, and the bill would be gone. Right. And that's what happened to the Duke's bills.
Well, I'll tell you what. I want to talk with you some more about Louisiana politics. I know Dron has some real misgivings about term limits, and there are many things happening today that are relevant to what happened when Ron was in the state legislature for a decade, and then he was a Secretary of Natural Resources after that. But thank you for joining us today, and glad you'll be at Natchitoches this week for the induction of Burl Shipley into the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame. It's just too bad that it's happening 3 years after his passing. Thank you, Ron.
You bet.
Take care. 297-5633, your number. We're joined now by Damian Eccles and Lori Davis. They met in 1996, were married in a Buddhist ceremony at Tucker Maximum Security Unit in Arkansas. This happened in 1999. Damian spent nearly 18 years on death row until his release in 2011, and they have written about their love story on death row and beyond. Damian Eccles and Lori Davis, yours for eternity, a love story on death row. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to hear both of your voices. And
thank you. Thank you for having us.
Well, Damian, you were one of the infamous West Memphis Three. And at 18, you and two other young men were suspected of killing three very young boys and in a most heinous crime. And you were given the death penalty. Did you ever think you'd be at this point at this time?
You know, I didn't really foresee exactly what the future would be. I had faith that eventually things would turn out okay, that eventually the truth would start to come out. I just didn't know how it was going to manifest, and I certainly didn't ever foresee taking an Alford plea. You know, I'd never even heard of such a thing, something where you legally maintain your innocence yet accept a guilty plea at the same time. You know, it defies logic and reason, so I never saw that coming. But at the same time, I did have faith that somehow, some way, things would turn out okay.
How did you get in the situation where you were thought to be the ringleader of this terrible crime? You and two other young men who also received harsh punishment for the alleged crime, of which you have now been vindicated. How are you a suspect to begin with?
I guess really what it comes down to is we lived in a very hardcore right-wing conservative fundamentalist town where I simply did not fit in. You know, I didn't conform to the local ideology or that local culture, so it made me stick out. It made me a target whenever something like this happened. You know, immediately they started, you know, all these rumors of human sacrifices and satanic rituals and all this sort of thing. And the fact that I dressed in black, I listened to Metallica, I read Stephen King novels, all of those things were presented as evidence in court. You know, literally they produced Stephen King novels and Metallica t-shirts as evidence not only that I was guilty of murder, but also that I had no soul. The prosecutor said, these things prove that I have no soul. This was the evidence they presented against me in court, and it was all they needed to have me sentenced to death.
Well, 3 8-year-old boys, Steve Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers, were reported missing on May 5th of 1993. The report to police was made by Byers' adoptive father. The boys were allegedly last seen together by three neighbors, and they were found, their bodies dismembered, terrible crime, and three young men, all in their teens at the time, Damian Eccles, Jesse Miskelly, and Jason Baldwin, they were the ones who were fingered as the suspects and later convicted for this crime, and it was thought that the children might have been killed as part of a satanic ritual. How did you react when you were brought in as a suspect and were convicted for a crime that the evidence now says you did not commit?
Well, a lot of it is you're just in shock and trauma. You know, I was, keep in mind, I was barely more than a kid myself. I was still a teenager at the time. and I've had my entire world ripped apart, my entire life destroyed. I've been accused of the most horrible things that you can be accused of. As the years would pass, I was tortured, I was beaten, I was starved. It wasn't an easy road. Whenever you're in that situation, really all you can do is keep trying to survive from one day to the next, to keep trying to put one foot in front of the other and make it through to another day. That's the only way you can get through it.
And you meet Lori Davis. I think Lori is with us. How did this happen?
Well, I was living in New York at the time, and I saw a film. I saw a documentary called Paradise Lost in 1996, and I was greatly affected by it. Just watching the film, you get enough information to know that a terrible injustice occurred in that community. And I'm from the South, too, so I understood the culture, having grown up in it. But I was also a bit of a, I don't want to say I was an outcast, but I was a bit of a rebel, and I was always questioning everything in my community and very curious about things, as is Damien. And so I felt a kinship to him, and it occurred to me that I could reach out to him and offer my help, and that's what I did by writing to him.
Well, the letters are moving, and they're in the book, Yours for Eternity. But many listenings think, how in the world does somebody fall in love with somebody on death row? How does that happen?
Well, I think as most relationships, it happens from a transference of ideas and communicating and getting to know someone. And we just had an opportunity to do it in a different way. And I think actually in a very profound way, because if you're getting to know someone by writing to them, you have a chance to reflect, you have a chance to express yourself in a different way rather than maybe just talking to each other on the phone or I don't know. It's passing. I don't think people are going to be writing letters like this in the future. There are other ways of corresponding, but for us, it was a very romantic, amazing way to get to know each other.
When were you married?
In 1999.
In 1999, and
yes.
Of course, Damien was released when?
In 2011.
So you waited 12 years.
Well, actually, I met him in 1996, and we were married in 1999. So that was about 3.5 years. And then we were married until he was released in 2011.
And 12 years later, he's released. They now live in New York, not in West Memphis. And we'll talk more about their remarkable story, Damien Echols and Lori Davis, Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row. 297-5633, your number, back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757, your number, wherever you are. Inkstershow at WRKF.org online. For anyone who followed the case of the West Memphis Three and read Damien Echols' New York Times best-selling memoir, Life After Death, there is a lingering question. Who was the woman courageous enough to fall in love with him and marry him while he remained on death row? Lori Davis was a landscape architect living in New York when she saw Paradise Lost. Lori, when you first meet Damien, what happens? Was there an immediate connection?
Well, we had already formed a very close connection from getting to know each other through writing to each other. But yes, the first time I saw him, immediately, yeah, he was lovely.
And what did you think, Damien?
Yeah, I'd been receiving letters from people pretty much all over the world, you know, just because of the Paradise Lost documentaries and people putting together websites about the case and things like that. But whenever I heard from Lori for the first time, I mean, in the very beginning, all the way in the very beginning, I knew this was someone completely and absolutely unlike anyone I'd ever known before. She had a way of seeing things that, you know, most people would think of as just mundane, everyday things, if they even thought of them at all. And the way she described them, it made me want to see the world through her eyes. You know, she saw them as much more magical. It made me want to be able to see things the way she did. And no one had ever really made me feel that way before. So I knew from the very beginning that this wasn't just another person in my life.
For those unfamiliar, the Tucker Maximum Security Unit in Arkansas is comparable to Angola in Louisiana. It's a huge operation, and it's not a place most people want to go. I would imagine it was a difficult 18 years for you.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was at one point in the last almost decade that I was there, I was moved to a super maximum security prison, one of the very few in the U.S. And at one point, a federal inspector came in and looked at it, and he said it was the worst conditions he had ever seen outside of Guantanamo Bay. One of my teachers, one of my meditation teachers that used to come in to the prison, said that the conditions we were being housed in did not even meet Geneva Convention standards for prisoners of war. It was incredibly hellish, incredibly brutal. There's no way that I could even describe it. And a lot of it at the time was, you know, I didn't want Lori to know all those things. I didn't want her to see how bad it really was, because then it would be like having to sit there and watch the person you love suffer right in front of your face and know there's nothing you can do about it but watch it happen. So even though it's that bad, you still kind of have to protect those you love from it.
Well, there have been movies and songs about that prison. I remember Bobby Darin's Long Line Rider. It's an infamous place, and I would imagine also you had the stigma of a person suspected and convicted of killing three young boys. That's not the kind of thing that other inmates really like.
I think that's usually more for probably people in regular prison situations. The way things like are on death row is people are a little more united than they are in other parts of the prison, just because you have a common enemy. You know, you have the state trying to murder you. No matter who you are, where you're from, what color you are, what crime you've been sent there for, you still have the state trying to put you to death. So people look at it as either you can squabble amongst yourselves, or you can put up at least a semi-united front and try to fight against the people who are trying to murder you.
Jonathan asks, how did you avoid the death penalty for 18 years before this 2011 agreement?
It was basically the state dragging it out as long as they possibly could. They knew that once we got into federal court, once we got beyond the state level court and the local politicians who had taken part in keeping it covered up for so long, they knew that the federal courts were going to overturn this case.
Right.
So they drug it out for as long as they possibly could. You know, just for example, the DNA testing, it took them 8 years to complete the DNA testing after we initially requested that it be done. It was basically stall tactics by the state.
Shannon asks about the release in 2011. You copped a plea, and you say it's an unusual agreement in which you are professing your innocence. But as I understand it, you said the government did have enough evidence to convict you. Is that essentially what the plea included?
Basically what it means, it's called an Alford plea. You know, I'd never even heard of such a thing before it was introduced into our case. What it comes down to is you are legally maintaining your innocence while accepting a guilty plea at the same time. The whole reason that it exists is so that the state can't be held responsible for what they've done. To this day, no one has ever been exonerated in the state of Arkansas, and this plea allowed them to maintain that. To this day, they still say they have never, ever in the entire history of the state of Arkansas sentenced an innocent person to prison. And this allows them to keep that up. It was one of those things, you know, Lori and I produced a documentary called West of Memphis. And in the documentary, the prosecutor actually says out of his own mouth, his number one priority, his number one concern was the fact that me and the other two men together could have collectively sued the state for $60 million, and it was his job to make sure that did not happen. You know, not only that, they're talking about $60 million. I got to keep in mind, these people can have me stabbed to death for $50 or a pack of cigarettes any day of the week, and nobody would ever think twice about it. You know, stuff like that happens in prison all the time.
Bill Clinton was president of the United States at the time this crime occurred. He, of course, was a 12-year governor of Arkansas. Did he follow the case closely?
I have no idea. You know, I don't know what really went on in Washington at that time. I was in prison. You know, when you're in prison, you're just fighting to survive from one day to the next. You don't really know what's going on in the outside world.
Lori, what's the overriding message of this?
There are many messages, but I would say for what Damien and I are putting out right now in our book is if you believe in something and don't give up. If you really believe in what you're doing in your life and if you have conviction, don't give up. And we're hoping that this book will inspire people in that way.
Who do you think killed these boys?
We always say we can't legally say. You know, we're not a judge. We're not the jury. We're not cops. But whenever they did finally do the DNA testing, the DNA at the crime scene matched one of the victim's stepfathers, as well as the man who was providing the stepfather with an alibi. We also had three eyewitnesses come forth who put that same person with all three of the victims within an hour of the time they were murdered. Yet the police still refused to even so much as look into it.
Well, it's quite a book. Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row, from Damien Eccles and Lori Davis. We thank you for joining us today, Damien and
Lori.
Thank
you for having us.
Take care.
You too.
Bye.
See you soon. And now we have a fascinating guest to close our show. This is a gentleman who many of us know best as a high wire artist, but we're about to find out much more. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is Philippe Petit. He's performed on the high wire more than 80 times around the world. Also practices the arts of magic, street juggling, drawing, and carpentry. He's a fascinating man, and he has written about his amazing life, creativity, the perfect crime, from Philippe Petit. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about your career as a high wire artist. This is not something most young people say, hey, you know, I want to grow up and I want to be a high wire artist. How did it happen for you?
Well, actually, I don't have a career in the sense that I'm not, you know, planning my next step, and I really live my life. But it is true that the calling of the high wire came quite early in my life. I had the chance, in a way, I was fortunate to not be born in the circus. So in that sense, I learned by myself while walking, and I was not carrying the tradition of the circus. So I am a very different wire walker than the one you find in the world. Talking about creativity, it actually started at a very early age when I learned by myself at age 6 how to do magic, and then juggling at age 14, and then the high wire at age 17. So, yes, it's a lifetime of creativity that I'm sharing in my 10th book.
It is creative, no doubt, but also daring. In 1974, 40 years ago, you, of course, had your epic and illegal walk between the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. What prompted that?
Well, it was planned, but you know, it came from the sky. One day, when I was 18 years old in Paris, I saw a newspaper clipping with the photo, not of the towers, they didn't exist at the time, but of an architectural model showing that those towers would be built. And I was just learning by myself to be a wire walker, and I thought, I have to put a wire between those towers. And then 6.5 years later, 6.5 years of dreaming and planning and nightmaring and coming to New York and meeting the towers and sneaking in, I finally managed to bring a ton of equipment at night and rig the wire between the towers, and in the morning walk over the world, you know.
Well, tell us about the dangers that were involved of you perhaps being stopped before you got started in 1974, and of course the walk itself was one that very few people would dare to do because of what would happen if something went wrong.
Well, I will surprise a lot of people, and I'm sure yourself, because of your question, that I would not see any danger. I mean, yes, of course, the act of wire walking without any protection, other than trying to, you know, to fly like a bird, seems dangerous to people or is dangerous by nature. But actually, since I value life immensely, my life and that of the building that I put my wire and that of the onlookers below, I never take risks and I never endanger my life. So when I step on the wire, it is with a joyful certitude, but not only in my brain, in my soul, but also invading my blood and in my body and bones and flesh. I have this certitude that the last step will be as solid as the first step. Now, of course, in the case of the World Trade Center, there were a few unknowns, such as the weather, the air currents, the vibration and moving of the towers themselves. But I had studied or I had practiced against strong wind. And I believe at that time, although, of course, it was a dangerous walk, to me, I was not in danger.
How long did it take you?
Well, I was not planning, since I was not like a circus daredevil, I was not planning to just walk across and scream, I did it. So how long it took me? Well, I didn't plan to do the 8 crossings that my friend witnessed. I didn't have a watch. I didn't look at the time passing. I didn't know I spent 45 minutes on the wire. But that's what the onlookers could see. They could see that I performed 8 crossings with, you know, dancing on the wire and laying down on the wire and genuflecting on the wire. And that actually I performed, for quite a long time. It was an impromptu a surprise, certainly, but an impromptu performance. I was improvising a quarter of a mile above the sidewalks of New York.
Is creativity, Philippe, is it often associated with danger?
No, but in my mind, there is a certain edge. One, in my view of creativity and in my experience of it, actually, that's what the book is about. It's a life of creating that I share with the reader. There is a need to be on the edge of your seat, to be on the edge of a void, to intellectually, certainly, to intellectually have a certain edge present, and the rebellion there that I associate with creativity is every day for me to see, because I try to abandon and to stay away from the beaten path, from the conventional way of thinking and creating, and therefore the word rebellion is not too strong.
Discipline is often associated with creativity. You certainly have that in abundance.
Yes, and it is difficult for me to tackle the discipline I need to achieve my project, and yet to be completely open to almost the opposite of discipline, to the fantasy and the chaos and the playfulness. And I welcome this world of contradiction. My life is made of contradiction. My book is actually full of contradictions. And I think that's very inspiring to me and to others, is that it's completely fine to venture in all kind of direction as long as you manage to collect yourself and to progress and to make the impossible happen.
Your book certainly offers a blueprint for creativity, but what advice in a sentence or two would you have for an artist who is trying to stimulate the creative being within?
Well, I try to stay away from giving advice, because, you know, I'm not a guru or a god, or I am a simple craftsman artist who keep learning every day and who keep fighting against all forces. So, but my one of the advice, in a way, what my encouragement will be to people who would ask me that question, would be surprise yourself. You know, do not live every day in the same exact manner. Wake up in the morning and look at the day like a blank canvas. Everything is possible to draw or paint on that canvas. So put your mind into surprising yourself, and do not live a dull. You will not be able to live a dull life if you surprise yourself every day.
Our guest has been Philippe Petit. the author of 10 books, including To Reach the Clouds, the basis of the 2008 Academy Award-winning documentary Man on Wire. His latest is Creativity, The Perfect Crime. Thank you, Philippe.
Oh, thank you.
Take care. And thank you for joining us today. And it is the 72nd birthday of Paul McCartney. He was to have performed tomorrow night at the Smoothie King Arena in New Orleans, across the street from the Superdome. But Sir Paul is having some vocal issues, and he will return on October 11th to New Orleans. 50 years ago on September 16th, the Beatles came to City Park in the Crescent City. Until tomorrow, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.